We frequently on Mondays visit with Elise Glink. You know her from Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. ThinkGlink.com is her website. Hi, Elise. Welcome back.
Hey, John. Nice to be here.
Lots of things to talk to you about today. And I actually, because I think about real estate when I think about you, let's just start with the apartment real estate world and what's happening there. What have you seen or noticed?
You know, it's interesting. There's a new study out that looked at how many office to residential conversions that we're seeing around the country. And what's interesting about that study, which came from Rent Cafe, they have website and platforms that actually help people manage their rental properties. But what they're seeing is that the number of office spaces that are going to be converted into places you can actually live has skyrocketed. In 2022, it was 23,100 units, and this year they're expecting a record-breaking 70,700 units, which is a pretty huge increase in a couple of years.
To what do you attribute that?
Well, there's been a lot of information and pressure, as we've talked about any number of times, about the fact that we're just missing millions and millions of places for people to live. We're just not keeping up with population growth and immigration, that there still is immigration in this country, and people need a place to live. And so what we've also seen and we've talked about is the fact that offices are vacant, office yeah. buildings, like the whole thing across the country. And many of those are now going into foreclosure and being sold back or taken back by the banks.
Sure, sure.
So you
might as well convert those. You know, it's funny when we were when the conversation in Chicago a year or two ago was, where are we going to put these migrants coming from Texas? People said, we've got all this empty office space. Why can't we house them there? And there was a whole host of reasons why maybe that would not be cost effective. But if it was for indefinite or long-term lodging, you know, an apartment, to me, that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. What's interesting is that there are a lot of office buildings that are not good candidates for adaptive reuse. And that's because the way that office buildings are built and constructed, especially in a downtown area, typically doesn't have the room for some of the amenities that you need. Also, like you've right. got the bathrooms in one spot and you need to put plumbing throughout, for example.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
in Chicago, we have a large number of buildings that actually do make sense for this, and we've seen it. And they're typically the older buildings that have windows that open that are built out of masonry construction of some sort. And so over the years, many of those buildings have been adapted. And now we've got a pipeline that encompasses about 3,600 units. That's up 28% from last year, according to Rent Cafe. And it is putting us into the number four spot in the country. Rent Cafe estimates that there's 67.5 million square feet of existing office space that could be suitable for residential conversion. That's about 18% of all the office space in the metro area. And in Chicago alone, 30 North LaSalle Street has 432,000 square feet of office space, and that's going to be revamped into 432 new apartments, including over 130 or about 130 affordable units. So really interesting to see how these things happen, and of course, they happen over time.
Yeah, I suppose it's not going to happen overnight, but I presume the greater inventory will maybe lower prices, or are these going to be, I know you said 100 and some odd affordable units, but I wonder if these will be high-end rentals. I guess what I'm hoping or trying to get at is, will this lower the cost of rent in Chicago?
Well, right now renting is doing a little bit better simply because a bunch of new properties have come up on the market. And so even if the new properties come at the higher end, that frees up people to move up. You know, much the way that if you have a two-bedroom apartment and you want to buy a house, that frees up the two-bedroom apartment for somebody else to move up to that, out of their studio, perhaps. So, you know, we can really foster growth on the lower end by also taking the top end out of the market and giving people a place to move to. And those are important pieces of the real estate market.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch on WGN Radio. Elise Glink joins us on Mondays. In fact, she's filling in for John Hansen tonight on Your Money Matters, right?
Yeah, that's true. John's got the night off, and I'll be sitting in, keeping the spot warm, and hopefully chatting a little bit more about some of these things. And also, I think we've got Herb Weisbaum, your consumer man, coming on, and he's got a few interesting things to talk about, too. So lots of good stuff.
Maybe we'll see how domestic steel manufacturers did today on the market. Steve was quoting some of their increased valuations, because if we're not going to import as much steel, if it's going to be 25% more expensive, presumably that helps American manufacturers. What are you seeing or hearing about that today?
Well, you know, sure, it helps those who are there, but how are you going to get all the building done? So President Trump announced that there would be a 25% tariff on all steel and aluminum imports starting on Monday, and reciprocal tariffs on our trading partners later this week. Now, the U.S. gets two-thirds of its primary aluminum from Canada. So if you just cut that off, or it gets a 25% tariff, yes, that's going to make things more valuable and helpful for people who are making aluminum or mining aluminum here in the U.S. It's also going to raise prices, right? Demand is going to stay where it is. It's not going to adjust down by two-thirds. And so I would expect all those prices to go up. Now, Canada is also the top steel supplier to the U.S., followed by Brazil, Mexico, South Korea, and Vietnam. This could affect all sorts of industries, commercial building, multifamily and office building. They use a lot of steel. We're also seeing houses that have steel supports go in for renovation and reuse. And then there's the automotive industry, and, you know, there's a lot of things that use steel. So, you know, eventually I think it would probably be okay, but I think it takes a long time to build a steel mill.
When the topic of tariffs came up a couple of weeks ago, we were reminded by some economists or thought people out there that a 25% tariff does not necessarily mean a 25% price increase, that A, the manufacturers will look for efficiencies. B, the manufacturers will absorb some of that cost because they won't be able to sell at a 25% increase. And C, the consumers will pay a higher price. But a 25% tariff does not mean a 25% price increase. Do you hear that sort of analysis also, Elise?
Well, yes, and I also hear the other side of it, where it is going to, you know, increase prices simply because there's the same amount of demand and a whole lot less supply. So again, right, going back to aluminum, if you're getting two-thirds of your aluminum from Canada, and I really don't know how much else comes from everywhere else, right? And you're now cutting off, you know, or two-thirds of that is going to have a 25% tariff. I just don't understand, since the U.S. producer can't possibly supply as much, for I don't know why they just wouldn't raise prices. They probably will, just because demand is overloading supply. And then also the amount that's coming in from Canada will be more expensive. I just don't see that the manufacturers will have the leeway or the financial wherewithal, because they answer to their overlords on Wall Street, to be able to absorb much of that. So maybe 18% price increase gets passed through instead of 25%.
I don't know what the number would be, but I do think about all the things that aluminum goes into. You were talking about steel, but obviously airplanes. And I presume that the
Coke
metal,
cans.
I was thinking about soda and beer. For a 12-ounce can or those 16-ounce tall boys, I wonder what percentage of the cost. I'd like to see a breakout. Like, how much of it is the sugar water? How much of it is shipping? How much of it is labor? Blah, blah, blah. How much of it is actually the cost of the can? And I suppose an increase in the aluminum would be an increase in the cost of a soda.
Yeah, I mean, even if it's a penny or two, and let's just say that that's what it is. You know, a penny or two may not make much of a difference to you or me. In fact, if a Coke costs us $1.05 instead of $1, I'm not sure you or I will ever notice that difference. However, on Wall Street, they do look at the pennies. And even though the Trump administration has decided to stop manufacturing pennies, it still matters on Wall Street. And so when you've got estimated profits and you've got estimated sales and you're, you know, looking at revenue and you're looking at costs, all of that stuff gets parsed over very, very closely by the analysts that cover that particular industry. And they're the ones who come out and say, okay, this is a good investment, this isn't a good investment. And that's reflected in what happens on Wall Street. So right now we've got this incredible stock market going on. But I could imagine that as some of these tariffs start to work their way through over the next 6 months, it's going to eat into profits if people, if the companies themselves absorb it. And if they don't, it's going to really change how revenue and profits are talked about.
Well, the administration is also proposing reduction in services from a lot of consumer protection agencies. I think that's more, I don't think that's about the cost of those items as much as it is other factors like the safety, et cetera. But do you have any connection maybe between some of these other actions, executive orders by the president, and what you're talking about?
Well, I'm a little worried about things like freezing USDA funds. Those go to support zero-cost loans for people, by the way, in real estate. You may not know that, but the U.S. Department of Agriculture not only supports our farmers and pays them money, it also provides government-backed loans and grants to farmers and other people who are trying to, sell their products and you know, buy new equipment and things like that. We all know that farmers are very much on just right on the edge of profitability as it is for most of them. And so they pay up front for fencing, for new crops, for installing renewable energy systems. And the government had given them, through the USDA, grants and loan guarantees to cover at least part of those costs. All that money is frozen. Now they're getting those payments rejected. I think that's going to put farmers, particularly family farmers, in a really, really tough spot. But the same thing is happening, you know, across, the Inflation Reduction Act, which did the same sort of thing, helping farmers, small business owners, municipalities fund ways to, keep down greenhouse gases, businesses that were going to help with electronic vehicles support, things like that. All of that money seems to be getting cut off. And then the CFPB, which has really returned the greatest amount of money to consumers, $20 billion since it was founded, in consumer relief by issuing rules on medical debt, bank fees, the way the credit reporting agencies operate. All of these things help consumers and act as a watchdog on behalf of consumers and U.S. businesses. The fact that they've shut that down is just terribly troubling to somebody like me, who worries about consumers and unfair, deceptive, and predatory practices by large financial institutions. It's just, I'm just overwhelmed by that. I think people are going to get ripped off, and you ought to get ready to get scammed, because I'm not sure anybody in the government has your back now.
That's Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. She's on for John Hansen tonight from 6 to 7 o'clock. You can follow her at thinkglink.com, and we'll listen for you tonight, Elise.
Thanks, John.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's Jim Dahlke, Director of Communications, Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. Welcome back, Jim. I'm glad you could join us today.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So, what did you think of the Super Bowl halftime show?
You know, I am a Kendrick Lamar fan, so I was perfectly fine with it. However, I, from the beginning, thought it was kind of an odd choice, just because he doesn't necessarily have the mass appeal that some previous Super Bowl halftime performers have had. So you kind of knew that a good chunk of the Super Bowl watching audience was probably not going to be as bored with it, potentially, as some of the previous performers have. But I thought he had a nice performance.
Well, clearly you weren't in the living room I was in then.
Yeah, I was involved with. I was on the scene reporting with the mother-in-law and the father-in-law crowd, and I can report that they weren't exactly loving it either.
I'll tell you what, my mom didn't get it. I'll tell you that right now. All right, let's talk about the collaborative Electrification 50. What is that?
Yeah, us here at TechNexus, so we put this report together Last week. And, you know, at TechNexus, we've been investing in startups really, across the world and across a bunch of different sectors and industries and themes. I mean, one of those themes has been electrification. TechNexus, we work with large Fortune 1000 corporations to invest directly into startups. And some of our corporate partners have been large RV companies and large boating companies. We've worked directly to help them invest in electrification solutions relevant to their business. And that's really allowed us to take this really interesting look at the electrification landscape, really, across the country and across industries, from agriculture to construction to marine, aviation, and more. And so we were able to put together this report called the Electrification 50, which really looks at 50 electrification startups here in the U.S. that are really electrifying the world around us. So on this list, which you can check out at connect.technexus.com, you'll find companies like Harbinger Motors. This is a really interesting company in the EV space. You know, everybody knows about the Teslas and the Rivians and the Lucid Motors. But, Harbinger Motors is, doing some really interesting stuff in the commercial EV space. They're working on medium-duty electric vehicles. So think kind of, mail delivery trucks. Think delivery trucks for your local bakeries. And they're actually working with our corporate partner, Thor, the RV company, to make the world's first hybrid RV. And so this is a company that just earlier this year raised $100 million round of funding. And is growing really quickly and is really filling a much-needed role in the medium-duty EV space for commercial vehicles. So lots of companies on this list, really kind of identifying the wide range of companies that are making electrification innovations across the U.S.
Well, that's what jumps out at me. It's not just that. It's the categories: recreational vehicles, marine, fleet and trucking, charging and infrastructure, agriculture and construction, aviation. There are going to be electric airplanes.
That's right. So, the electrification, it's really, not a matter of if, it's when. We really believe that, the world is headed in this direction, and it's just really a matter of time. Of course, EV sales have been in the headlines forever. The industry has just not exactly, driven the growth in the EV space, from the car market as folks had expected. But we're seeing a lot of demand, certainly beyond automobiles and into all different kinds of sectors. And really, it's just a matter of time. Batteries are getting better. Access to charging is increasing. And we're going to see, transition to an electric future. And it's happening in ways that you may not even realize. There's a company on this list, Impulse Labs. They're developing a all-electric range that can boil your water in 40 seconds, right? So, water to boil almost instantly. And so there's companies really all throughout this list that are doing some really impressive stuff in electrification.
I have not met the person who's unhappy with their electric car, and maybe some of them are out there. The only complaint we all hear is about infrastructure, and I guess that's what stalled some of the enthusiasm or purchases of those things. But I wonder if this whole category of industries, or all of these categories, I wonder if they see some headwinds for the next 4 years, and are they sort of baking that into their business plans, and they're hopeful that in the next 4 years maybe there will be a change in Washington that will be more favorable to green technology and electrification. What are you hearing about all of that?
Yeah, I think for folks that are believers in this space, you believe much further out than four-year time cycles, So I think even if, certain things in Washington aren't going in your favor, if you're an electrification business, if you're a green tech startup, you're planning for more than 4 years. And certainly the private sector hopefully can step up and maybe fill some funding gaps where, the public sector won't. But, we'll have to kind of see, right? It's going to be an interesting 4 years for, climate tech businesses, green tech businesses. But, one of the president's closest ally is the leader of an electric car startup or electric car business, right? So, I mean, it's kind of this double-edged sword that I think many in this industry aren't exactly sure, where it's headed. And it could be a bumpy 4 years. But, if you're a believer in, the future of EVs, the future of electrification, you're thinking much further out than what's going to happen in these next 4 years.
Well, and I, one of the things I've heard smarter people than me say about this is we can say, think, do, feel whatever we want. China, South America, Russia, the rest of the world is going electric. We just can't sit on the sidelines. If we choose to, we do so at our own peril. And one of the reasons perhaps you haven't heard Elon Musk bark about some of the Trump administration plans about their indifference to green energy or electric cars is that if that hurts the industry, no car manufacturer is better positioned to weather that storm than Tesla. They're the market leader. So these other companies, including the big three or whatever, that are making electric cars or hybrids, will struggle more in that sector. But Tesla has a head start. They'll manage this. This might actually be good for Tesla in the short run. Do you hear anything like that?
Yeah, I mean that's certainly possible, right? That certainly could be baked into Elon Musk's philosophy and how he's thinking about all this in general. But certainly the growth of the EV market is going to be good for Tesla, right? The rising tides are going to lift all of these ships, and I don't think that they're going to be by any means the only player in this space. And so I think that it certainly behooves Tesla to have, increasingly friendly regulations around electric vehicles. And, exactly what Elon Musk's motives are kind of to be determined in this, I suppose. But, certainly I think, his business is going to be advocating for, better regulatory environments for electric vehicles.
Charging and infrastructure. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You guys list 6 companies that are doing notable things in that category alone.
Yeah, and charging is so important, right? I mean, having access, to reliable electric charging is going to be, paramount to the growth of this industry, right? And so, access to charging, being able to reliably, get power to your vehicles is so important. And as we were just talking about, Harbinger Motors, they're making these EVs for commercial vehicles. It's a great use case, right? Because those types of vehicles that are shift driven is designated downtime every single day, right? They're not being driven during this shift where they're off, so they have the perfect time to be charged. So it's a great business opportunity for a company like that, which is going to have an electric vehicle for a bakery delivery van, which from certain hours at night is never going to be on the road. Perfect time to charge it. So these are great kind of business opportunities for these electric vehicle companies.
You can see this list at TechNexus Venture Collaborative. Jim Dahlke is the Director of Communications there. We'll catch up on more next week, Jim. Thanks for your thoughts today.
Thanks, John.
More business news now on the Wintrust Business Lunch with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Chicago-based Hyatt Hotels is buying Playa Hotels and Resorts for $2.6 billion. The acquisition enables Hyatt to expand into the all-inclusive resort market in countries like Mexico and Jamaica. Hyatt had previously been an investor in Playa. It joins Marriott and Hilton in expanding its hotel network. The Hyatt deal is expected to close later this year. Improving international sales helped McDonald's overcome weakness in the U.S. in the fourth quarter. McDonald's same-store sales fell 1.4% in the October to December period after an E. coli outbreak dented demand. It expects demand to return to normal by the beginning of second quarter. McDonald's says demand from low-income consumers also remains weak despite its expanded value menu. McDonald's saw strong sales growth in Japan and the Middle East in the fourth quarter. It reported revenue of nearly $6.3 billion, just short of what Wall Street was expecting. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Here's that Business of Food report with Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. Does this sound like you? You have had it with the cost of eggs, and you're going to buy some chickens and put them in your backyard and raise your own. You'll show them, by golly. Well, you're not alone.
No, a lot of people thinking the same thing.
Who that is, and more about backyard chickens after I thank the Chevy Silverado for sponsoring us today. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. Find out how at ChevyDrivesChicago.com. On the phone is a woman who knows all about backyard chickens.
My name is Brooke Bastuina, and I'm the owner of the feed store in Summit, Illinois.
And the feed store is a great place to start if you have questions about backyard chickens, such as, can I buy a hen and get eggs right away? The answer is no.
So when we receive chicks from the hatchery, they are about 1 or 2 days old. They ship them right through the mail.
Okay, well, how long will it take for those baby chicks to grow up and lay eggs? Brooke says about a half a year.
Depending on the breed of chicken.
Okay, well, how many eggs will I get per day?
It depends on the breed as well. So all different chickens lay all different times and lay all different colors as well as different schedules for laying. So you may get a chicken that can lay one egg per day, and that's probably the most you're going to get.
Okay, one egg a day per hen, and how much will it cost?
It's not going to be cheap. You do have to house them, feed them, take care of them, so the labor and the costs involved are not quite worth, you know, depending on how expensive eggs get now.
And the wild card right now? The bird flu.
Keeping them out of contact with the wild birds is the most important thing right now, which is kind of hard to do unless you have them completely sealed up in a coop. And these birds like to free range and things like that. But I wouldn't discourage anybody from raising backyard chickens. You know, they have to be inside for a month or two when they're babies anyways.
So there are challenges, but
they make wonderful pets, and you're going to get a lot of information from us if you come here to help you keep your birds healthy and happy.
And where do we find you?
We're at 5408 South Harlem Avenue, one block off of I-55 on Harlem Avenue in Summit, Illinois.
Oh, and one more thing. Be sure and check with your city or village to see if chickens are allowed. And maybe give your neighbors a heads up. On the food calendar, it's National Cream Cheese Brownie Day. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Valentine's Day's right around the corner. Guess what the number one gift is? Here's Matt Schultz, Chief Credit Analyst at LendingTree. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how are you?
Number one gift is chocolate, right?
You got it. Chocolate and candy, and then like a special meal out were the two most common things on Valentine's Day. So no great shock there.
No, but one thing that is on the list that you all noted, experiential gifts. And that's 17% of us compared to 23% for chocolates. So it's up there. And I wonder if that's new. I presume that means doing something together more than just a dinner, right?
Yeah, and it really kind of goes with the trend that we've seen over the years of people preferring experiences over things. And honestly, it can be a good way to potentially have a good Valentine's experience without spending as much money, because that sort of stuff doesn't necessarily cost all that much.
How much do people spend on Valentine's Day?
The average is about $180. It's a big split between men who are at about $260 and women who are a little over $100. But the average is about $180.
And that's probably dinner for two and a gift or a card or something like that, huh?
Yeah, depending on where you live, $180 may not even cover the the dinner tab. But yeah, that is kind of all things encompassed.
What about the demographics of that? Are baby boomers more likely to spend more than, say, Gen X?
Well, what we found is actually that younger Americans are more likely to spend more on Valentine's Day. Gen Z and millennials are both around $250, and baby boomers are at about $89. So there's a big difference there, and it's also probably tells you a little bit something about comfort of relationships and that sort of thing.
I don't need to prove anything to you. We've been together long enough, so here's a
card. That's basically it.
I don't mean to put it that way. And a lot of that, I guess, is being put on credit cards then, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And what we see is that about a third of Americans say that they may take on Valentine's Day debt. That's an awful lot of people. And for most people, we're only talking about a couple of months. But even so, taking on a couple of months over something like Valentine's Day, unless you're talking about an engagement ring or things like that, it's probably not the best idea.
A couple of months to pay off $180 maybe, but you're probably layering that on $10,000 of credit card debt you already have. What's the balance most people have?
Well, the average balance is somewhere around $6,000. And right now, everybody is kind of at their peak because we're still paying off holiday debt. So Valentine's Day debt on top of that is not great.
And what's the rate most folks are paying, Matt?
average rate on a new credit card today is about 24%, which is not quite at the all-time record high that we saw last year, but isn't far from it.
We're talking about Donald Trump saying that he wants to get rid of the penny. He'll probably soon discover how difficult that good idea is, like everything in the federal government. But in reading about that, I saw that the percentage of transactions at stores that are cash transactions is 18%. So 82% of our transactions are either credit card, debit card, you know, maybe Venmo or something like that. Do those numbers sound about right to you?
Yeah, and it's only getting more so. I mean, I don't think we will ever be a quote-unquote cashless society, but we are certainly moving away from most people using cash on a regular basis or even carrying that much of it when they go around.
Well, so I think I know what you're going to say, but then what's the friendly reminder here from the chief credit analyst at LendingTree? What advice do you have for folks?
The friendly reminder is that your partner probably doesn't want you to take on debt over Valentine's Day. And if they do, that may be a bit of a red flag in the relationship.
Hey, now.
So, so that means it's there are things that you can do to show how much you care for that person without going into too much debt, and that's really what you should do.
Matt Schultz is the chief credit analyst at LendingTree.com. Nice to talk to you as always, Matt. Thanks for the help.
Thank you.